Folk session number 12693, Reel 1.
Mr. Green, Reel 1, whereabouts were you born, please?
In Fulham, West London.
Which year was that?
1924.
And what did your father do for a living?
He was a carpenter.
His own business?
No, he worked for Harrods.
Did you go to school in that area?
Yes, in Fulham, and then at secondary school in Kensington.
How old were you when you left?
When I left secondary school, I was nearly 19.
So this was in the war?
Yeah.
How did you get to be interested in politics?
Well, my father was a left-winger. He was in the Labour Party in the mid-30s. Then he joined the Communist Party towards the end of the 30s. My older brothers were interested, so I became interested, I suppose.
What kind of literature did you read at first, which had a big influence on you?
Well, I was in hospital when I was 9 and 10, and laid flat for 6 months at one period, so I read voraciously, and I read the whole of Dickens at that stage, and I think Jane Austen and Thackeray. But under my father's tutelage, I read a lot of, you know, the famous classic was Robert Tressel's Ragged Trousered Philanthropist, and things like that. Jack London was another great influence. All that kind of popular left-wing revolutionary literature. I think I went on then to Theodore Dreiser and André Malraux and people of, you know, rather more cultured than left-wing, as it were, in my teens. Of course, being at a Catholic school at the time, I ran into certain difficulties because my father was also a practising Catholic, and as were the whole family. So we used to go to Catholic Church in Chiswick High Road and some days and come out and form up for the May Day or some other political procession on the other side of the road.
So the literature you were reading, the left-wing literature, was novels rather than political theory?
Yes, we read Left Book Club material as it came out. A lot of that was, you know, non-fiction. Some was fiction, but mainly non-fiction. I kept up with that.
What Left Book Club volumes in particular?
Well, there was one by Clement Attlee called The Labour Party in Perspective. There was things by people like Cedric Belfridge and Palm Dutt and I suppose Maurice Torres from France. And I think some of Gollancz's own volumes. Things on Spain, of course.
Did you join a political organisation yourself?
Not until after the war, because I was at Catholic school until about a month before I joined up in 1943. So, of course, I didn't join the Young Communist League, as I would have done if I'd not been at school. And of course, then I joined the army, but I always counted myself as a committed communist or whatever, although I didn't expect to join the Communist Party until I was demobbed in 1947.
Was there any Mosleyite presence in Fulham before the war that you remember personally?
Fulham, no, I don't. No, sorry, we left Fulham when I was about 9 in 1933 and went to live in Chiswick, and there were certainly Mosleyites there. And they used to have open-air meetings in Chiswick High Road and on Turnham Green itself, and we used to go along to heckle. And of course, my father went to the famous Olympia meeting in, forget the date of that, 1934, and I think was thrown out. We used to go to the East End to demonstrate against Mosley. But we also, I think, got talking to some of the young black shirts on a rather more reasonable, you know, what's all this about, and rather than just shouting and screeching at them, which I thought wasn't a bad thing, although it wasn't viewed very favourably by a lot of left-wingers. I mean, the idea was that Mosleyites and fascists were kind of beasts incarnate and you couldn't, no point reasoning with them.
Did you get anywhere with the attempt to discuss with them?
I think a little, but what intrigued me was that some people, young people, looking for an identity or the right cause, joined the Young Communist League or the Labour Party, Labour League of Youth, and then told us that they'd been in black shirts or Mosleyites. So obviously they benefited from some kind of sane discussion.
Did you get any people moving the other way from the Labour Party and Communist Party to the Mosleyites?
Not that I can remember. I mean, you know, the big exodus from the left was in the late 40s, but not in the pre-war stage. I mean, people left the Labour Party and joined the Communist Party. People left the Liberals and joined the Labour Party or the Communist Party, like the Carrot brothers. But and Bill Carrot was also in India, of course. I think there was a certain amount of two-way movement, but mainly to the left, from what I recall.
Although you didn't join anything before the war, were you attending meetings, discussion meetings and that type of thing?
Yes, I went to Communist Party meetings, and even when I was evacuated to Windsor in 1943 with this Catholic school, we used to walk once a week to a Communist Party place in Staines and go to meetings there. I mean, at the ripe age of 16. I wasn't a member and was advised not to join, in fact.
Who advised you then?
Pardon?
Who advised you then?
Well, I think, you know, communists in the branches who I said, well, I reckon I ought to join. And they said, oh, no, it's best for you to stay at school and get the best qualifications you can. And if you joined, you could be expelled and goodness knows what. And that would be all wasted.
Do you think that was good or bad advice?
Oh, I don't think I liked the advice at the time, but I can see now that it was good advice.
So this was the Staines Communist Party branch, was it?
Yes, it must have been. I can't remember the name of anybody there. Some other lads from the Catholic school went with me, three or four of us, I think. We must have been badly supervised because we used to go out of the hostel where there was a teacher supposed to be in charge of us and walk to Staines and go to the meeting and walk back, and I don't suppose we got back till 11 o'clock at night, so nobody ever missed us or asked where we were.
Did you also attend the Chiswick Communist Party branch?
No, not till really more after the war. Well, I was the secretary of one of the Chiswick Communist Party branches within weeks of being demobbed because they were short of people who take on the job. But I didn't have much contact with them when I was at Windsor, you know, because my father's attitude was I was evacuated to avoid the bombing and so on, and it was pointless for me to be running back to London half the time.
When Chamberlain declared war in 39... were you old enough to have an attitude towards that?
Oh, yes, I was. I think I must have been a quite sectarian and hard-line communist then. I was then. I heard the Chamberlain's broadcast, which was on the 3rd of September. Was it a Sunday?
Yes.
Huh?
Yes.
Yes. I was then evacuated, and I was billeted with a lady, a titled lady, Lady Bell, who lived in a great house and estate in Stoke Poges, and she ushered us into the lounge to hear the broadcast. You know, within weeks I was arguing with the teachers and everybody else that it was a phony war, and you know, pointing out that Chamberlain was getting up in the House of Commons and reeling off long lists of arms and equipment which were being sent not to France to fight the Germans, but to Finland to fight the Russians.
Was there any dispute in the Staines branch that you attended about what attitude should be adopted towards the war in 39?
No, I can't really remember much of those meetings at all. I think we were very much regarded as a bit of a curiosity, and in fact I don't suppose it was more than a half a dozen meetings we went to through the winter of 39 and 40. I don't think there was much disagreement with the party line, which then changed, of course, when Harry Pollitt gave up being General Secretary. And the books I've read, which are very good on the period, which have appeared in the last few years, I can agree with now, but we certainly thought that it was an imperialist war, especially when the French communist deputies were imprisoned and so on.
What about the Molotov-Ribbentrop Pact? How did that have an effect on you?
Well, again, I suppose you might could say I was rather gullible. We took our line from the notes by Palm Dutt in Labour Monthly, which was the Bible, certainly my father's Bible. And I remember the Molotov Pact. I remember going to a meeting at Cheney Street near London University. And Harry Pollitt spoke to a huge meeting there. 7, 8, 10, 12,000 people probably filled the whole street. And I always remember him, because we were all wondering what he was going to say. And there was enormous tension as he got up to speak. And he started off by saying, what I remember, there's an old saying, you never miss your mother till she's gone. And of course the whole crowd collapsed into laughter, which was relief, and so on. And he then went on to say, you know, we've now got to stand on our own, and this is... Then he went on to give a explanation. But
what exactly did he mean by that?
Well, he meant, you know, the Soviet Union there is no longer there to, as Stalin in fact said in his historic speech, to pull the chestnuts out of the fire, you know, to do the fighting for the Western democracies, while... And of course there was this big feeling in the left throughout the 30s, and even in fact as far as back to the 20s, that the Red Army was going to come in and sort it all out for us. The Germans had a song about this, you know. And, you know, if things got too bad, the sort of... Well, as with Spain, I suppose.
What song did the Germans have?
Oh, they used to sing the songs, the Red Arm, the Red Air Force song was a favourite one. Flying higher and higher and higher, our emblem, the Soviet star, with every propeller roaring red front, defending the USSR, which was, I think, symptomatic of the time. You know, the Soviet Union wouldn't let us down. And that's what Pollitt meant, I think, by this phrase, you never miss your mother till she's gone. He meant that the apron strings had been severed, cut, and you know, we were on our own, as it were.
But, and that was within a few days of the pact, was it?
Yes, it must have been the next weekend, I think. You know.
Was that an open air or an indoor
meeting? Open air.
But was he condemnatory of...
No, I think the, you know, he put forward the reasons why it was done, and the Soviet Union had a difficult choice between the Germans and the British, who didn't really want a popular front, didn't really want resistance to Hitler, you know, he pointed out our Lord, was it Lord Strang or Sir William Strang, had been sent to negotiations in Moscow and went by boat to Murmansk, which took days and days instead of flying, you know, which there was not much sense of urgency about the whole thing.
Were you in any of the bombing yourself?
No. No, there were a few odd bombs on Windsor, but very few, and there were some on Slough, which presumably could have easily fallen on us, but we saw a bit of damage. But we had air raids, and we, in fact, had some lessons in air raid shelters. But there was very little bombing on Windsor, you know. Popular idea was that the Germans respected the royal family and didn't want to drop bombs on Windsor.
You described your own attitude towards the war as sectarian in September 39, but when the big crisis came with the fall of France and Dunkirk and the Battle of Britain, did your attitude towards the war change then?
Yes, I think it did. When I say sectarian, I don't mean merely my attitude to the war. I mean to politics in general. You know, I was, I suppose in a sense this was similar to my Catholic attitude, that if a thing was worth doing, it was worth doing well. And if the party and the Soviet Union thought this was an idea, well, then I thought it was a good idea.
So there was an element of obedience in it, you mean?
Yes, I think so. Yes, certainly.
You're going to tell me about how it might have changed in the summer of 40, though.
Yes, I think that, again, the tenor of the left-wing ideas was that Dunkirk was, you know, a very brave and admirable thing. It was the ordinary soldiers who had fought their way out after being let down by the brass hats, etc. You know, this kind of thing, and a kind of analysis which sounded a bit like 1914 to 18. But I think it became, you know, the left saw it more of a war of self-defence then. I mean, it wasn't a jingoistic war against Germany so much now, because, you know, we weren't doing anything much against Germany. We were just defending ourselves.
So you mean there was more of an inclination to support the war effort?
Yes, I think it took on the overtones of a patriotic war, and, you know, there was arguments about what would happen if the Germans invaded, and who would be the Quislings, and and who would lead the resistance, as in Europe.
Who did you think would?
Well, we thought the Communist Party and the left, and what was then the People's Convention, which kind of unity effort, would form the kind of spearhead of the resistance, and many of the right wing in the Conservative Party would be only too willing to help the Germans, as, you know, the flight of Rudolf Hess showed, and the reception that he got.
Then can we go on to June 41 and the German attack on Russia?
Well, yes, I can. I can see myself standing outside the sixth form room with the history teacher and talking about what was going to happen. And of course, he said the Germans would be at the gates of Moscow and Leningrad, and it would all be over within weeks, before the end of the summer holiday, I think. And then he turned to a group of eight or nine sixth formers and said, and what does the member from Moscow think? I was the member from Moscow, of course. And I said, well, I think that the Russians will fight hard and resist the Germans as much as they can. And I said, I think it will be a long, bitter, drawn-out conflict, but I think in the end the Soviet Union will win. I said, because I think they're the only country that's faced Germany, which has been united, and with a strong leadership and with a record of resistance to fascism, and I think they'll give a very good account of themselves.
Had it taken you by surprise that the German attack took place?
Yes, I think it did.
Well, Were those your real feelings of confidence, or was there an element of whistling in the wind?
Well, yes, I was 17 then, so obviously I hadn't based it on any depth of strategical analysis. It was just what the left said and what I wanted to think and what I thought did think too. I mean, and as it turned out, a lot of it was largely true, but yes, I said what I thought that the Russians said they were going to do, and I think to a large extent they did it. Of course, at this time we didn't realise they could have done it enormously better if they'd not shot so many of their generals and leading cadres and whatever. But no, as I say, at barely 17, I wasn't giving a reasoned analysis. Bit of wishful thinking, as you say.
Did the German attack on Russia affect the political campaigning that you did?
Oh yes, because immediately there were possibilities of, you know, broad fronts, as it were. I mean, you know, collecting money for the Russian Red Cross, Lady Churchill's appeals. Just as, in fact, one of my first political acts was, at the age of 14, was to collect money for Spain. When I went round on my newspaper round, I used to take a tin. And anybody that read the News Chronicle or the Daily Herald or the Daily Worker or whatever, I would ring the bell and get money from them from Spain. So that the same kind of thing happened after 41. I mean, there was collections for Russian tanks and all kinds of things like that, in which, of course, conservatives and Labour and right across the political spectrum joined in. So communist political work became more for production, tanks for Joe and so on, you know, and less separate, isolated and sectarian and, you know, non-popular as it had been up to then.
How did you come to be in the forces yourself, and what was your attitude towards joining up?
In the forces, well, I put a lot of it in the document. We had at school a number of visitors from the Air Force recruiting agents. They were from the Navy, from everywhere, and one was from the Indian Army. And this reminded me of my grandfather, and he had a book of postcards, I think they must have been, of India. Very old Victorian kind of daguerreotype things, which fascinated me. And of course, when I heard about this Indian Army cadetship, I thought, well, yeah, that sounds good. I'll get out of England. And as a youngster of 19, I felt quite a few constraints. I mean, there were physical constraints. You couldn't go to the seaside. You couldn't go out after dark. You weren't supposed to. And the idea of travelling halfway across the world was very attractive. And I'd read Kipling and a number of books on India. I'd read Ben Bradley's account of the Meerut trial in the 1930s, and political books like that. So I was, you know, quite interested. And when I joined, when I had my medical, I think, at Reading, I told them there that I filled in the forms. And so I was sent for on early in June, soon after I left school, to report to the Hotel Great Central in Marylebone Road. And so I became a cadet in the Indian Army. And then 10 days or so later, we went to Glasgow, to Gourock, and got on a troop ship.
A cadet not attached to any particular unit?
Well, it was just a draft of cadets who were going to Bangalore to train as officers for the Indian Army.
When was it that you set off from Gourock, do you think?
Must have been about the sometime towards the end of June, I think. I think I joined up on the 4th or the 6th, I thought.
You haven't put a date here, but you put June 43.
June, yeah. And so it must have been towards the end of June. We did 2 or 3 weeks training, PE, running in Regent's Park, and had all our jabs and talks on VD and tropical diseases. I think we had more injections than, you know, we'd ever had before in our lives. Typhus and tetanus and a lot, you know.
Which ship did you sail in from Clydeside?
Pardon?
Which ship did you sail in?
Oh, the ship was called the John Ericsson. And again, we heard, we went all halfway round the Atlantic, and we went into Freetown. We were landed there on the 4th of June, 4th of July, which was American Independence. There were American naval units there.
Were you in convoy or simply?
Yes, yeah, very much so. We heard after we landed in Cape Town that the John Ericsson went round to Durban while we went across by train from Cape Town to Durban, and we heard that the John Ericsson was sunk by U-boats between Cape Town and Durban. Whether this was true or just rumour, I don't know.
What kind of a ship was it?
Well, it was it was a very, very crowded ship. There were, I should think, 4,000 or 5,000 or more troops on it, and one of the first things I remember was going to the toilets, and they didn't have doors on the toilets. They just had about 150 toilet seats in rows of about 25, and one of my first introductions to army life was, you know, seeing 150 men all sitting on toilets without screens or doors or anything else, you know. Say nothing of what happened when the ship pitched and tossed in the Atlantic.
Did you meet the enemy on the way to India?
Well, there were, you know, there was gunfire and there was planes flying overhead, and sometimes people said they were Germans or Italians. And by all accounts, one of the ships near us in the convoy was hit, because I remember taking survivors being taken on board. But, you know, we weren't dive bombed or hit at all. I mean, so it was quite an anonymous thing. We, as I say, we didn't see the Germans. Of course, between West Africa and the Cape was a happy hunting ground for submarines in those days, and a lot of convoys did lose ships down there, but either we didn't, or if we did we didn't know anything about it. I mean, they didn't tell us. Bad for morale, I suppose.
Did you arrive at Bombay?
Well, we went, as I say, we went from Cape Town to Durban, and we met some very racist white South Africans, because when we were walking down the streets in Cape Town with West Indian crewmen from the boat, we were told that this wasn't done and that they were blacks.